them being held accountable and for giving them, in fact, medals of freedom to move on to their life, it's a travesty, I think.
We're going to have to leave it there. Colonel Stephen Kleinman, former military intelligence officer who trained in interrogation, trained soldiers in interrogation. And I want to thank Dror Ladin of the ACLU. And that does it for this program. I'll be speaking tonight at Seattle Town Hall at 7:30, Saturday at Mount Vernon at noon at the Lincoln Theater, Sunday in Eugene, Oregon, University of Oregon, and in Portland at 7:30 at the Aladdin Theater. You can go to our website at democracynow.org. A very special belated happy birthday to Dennis Moynihan. And special thanks to the staff and student crew here at Bellevue College, Steve Ramsey, Rick Oddy, Ruthie Bly, Samer El-Shamari, Evan Tillett, Ellison Shea, Judy Lindsay Kalma, Bob Nash, Ellison Shea, Gary Goto, Deepa Tom. Thanks to Laura Gottesdiener. I'm Amy Goodman. We're in Washington. Thanks so much for joining us.
The time is 5 p.m. This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next is your KBOO Evening News.
Thanks, you guys.
Thank you so much for your support.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for all your support during our recently completed spring membership drive. We can't do it without you. Thanks to all of our renewing members, our new members, and everyone who helped get KBOO to this fantastic place it is today. We really appreciate it. Thank you.
I wanna thank you, baby, for loving me. I wanna thank you, baby, for loving me.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Fellow Americans.
Hello, teenage America. My name is Susie Cream Cheese.
Ah, the French. Yes, that's right. It's Mother's Night. It's that time of year again. And for over 35 years, on the Friday before Mother's Day, KBOO honors our mothers, mothers of invention, that is, with an annual all-night marathon celebrating the early recordings of those untamed geniuses, the mothers of invention. Beginning at 10 p.m. this Friday night and going till 6 in the morning, 8 very short hours from the canon of Frank Zappa, featuring rare Mothers of Invention recordings, unreleased audio disturbances, concert excerpts, dance contests, Zappa interviews, television invasions, fuzzy dice, and rare recordings that the collectors bring in every year that you've probably never heard before, not even last year. So join us for Mother's Night this Friday night at 10 p.m. here on 90.7 FM KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon's Department of Education advocates for safer policies for transgender students.
As the Oregon primary nears, over 100,000 Oregon voters have switched their party registrations.
And the tar sands fires in Alberta, Canada, rage on.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, May 6, 2016. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Linda Olson-Osterland. Multnomah County Sheriff Dan Stanton did not break any criminal laws when he gathered information on the members of the Charter Review Committee as they explored whether or not the sheriff should be appointed rather than elected. That was the finding this week from the Oregon Department of Justice. It is illegal in Oregon for law enforcement to investigate individuals who are not suspected of committing a crime. Stanton has argued that his staff was just, quote, Googling the Charter Review Committee members to learn more about their backgrounds. David Rogers, executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon, criticized the finding today as falling short of a real examination of the situation. Rogers said that the Department of Justice's conclusions represent only a part of the picture because their investigators focus solely on violations of criminal law, not civil or administrative laws. Rogers said, quote, The DOJ's findings strongly suggest to us that Sheriff Stanton violated the civil law that protects Oregonians from state surveillance, as well as free speech and association rights, end quote.
April 26th was the last day to change one's party affiliation in the state of Oregon, and over 110,000 residents did that. Over 75% of those who switched affiliation joined the Democratic Party. Oregon's closed party primary system was one reason for switching party affiliation, especially because the state has such a high number of voters identifying as independent. Though Oregon's primary elections won't have much of an impact on the Republican side of the race, the state's Democrats will most likely heavily lean toward Bernie Sanders, despite Hillary Clinton's delegate lead. Oregon's primary is May 17th.
Two teenagers in Cowlitz County are challenging the adage that young people don't participate in elections. KBOO reporter Jamie Haddad has the story.
11th edition is still widely used, and that's what I tend to use. And my duties as parliamentarian at the convention consisted of making sure that we followed the agenda correctly, any inquiries that anybody had as to how the proceedings were going to go, because there was some discussion about the platform of the Democratic Party for the county and all the debate and whatnot and how voting works. So it was just generally trying to keep things in order and running smoothly.
Both of the teenagers have future political aspirations, to some degree. Nipper hopes to soon attend the Democratic Convention as a delegate.
I've been promoting myself on several Facebook pages to try to raise attention that I'd like to be a national delegate. But within Cowlitz County, I don't have many major plans. My main concern is heading towards the congressional district election, which will be in Vancouver on May 21st.
As millennials, conversations with peers about the elections range from support to jest.
Me and another friend of mine are typically the spokesperson for that, but everyone is, we talk about it, we make jokes about it, we spoke fun at whoever we like and whichever. I get so many Bernie Sanders jokes shoved at me every day from everybody. It's all in good fun.
Both teens encourage others to get involved in political processes in this election cycle.
The best thing you can do is to take the leap of faith and put yourself out there, because when you go to these conventions, you see people from multiple generations who are looking at this. Many of them may have a negative view about it if things aren't running smoothly. And all it takes is one voice saying, I'll take this on and I'm willing to put myself out there for all of you, and you can reinvigorate an entire electorate with one simple action.
For KBOO News, I'm Jamie Haddad.
Portland Public Schools has reached a settlement with Oregon Public Broadcasting, OPB, over public meeting laws. A Multnomah County judge ruled in favor of Portland Public Schools, saying the district was lawful in closing those meetings to the public. OPB filed a suit against the school district in November 2014 after Portland Public Schools closed some Superintendent's Advisory Committee on Enrollment and Transfer meetings to the public. OPB said the meetings were legally required to be open to the public because the committee was advising the school superintendent. The committee had recently made final recommendations to change the district's controversial transfer lottery and to prevent families from moving from one neighborhood school to another. With the ruling, Portland Public Schools agreed to provide training and clear written guidelines for board members and administrators about public meetings. Portland's Advisory Committee on School Boundaries will begin meetings again this spring.
The Portland Public Schools Board unanimously passed a resolution this week to start teaching ethnic studies in high schools. The idea of creating a curriculum for the non-white history of the United States has been gaining traction, and a similar resolution could be presented across Oregon. Emmy Kunze of KBOO News, in conjunction with the Oregon News Service, has more.
The diverse history of the United States will reach Portland High School students in 2018 thanks to a resolution unanimously passed by the city's public school board this week. The student-led group, Asian and Pacific Islander Leaders for the Liberation of Youth, or ALI, led the charge to bring ethnic studies courses to all 9 Portland high schools. Diego Hernandez of Momentum Alliance, an organization that supported the resolution, says the courses will better reflect the histories of the students in the classroom.
So if you have students who don't see themselves in the textbooks because they've been not included, they're going to not relate and not be engaged in history or social studies. We know we can change that.
The demographic of Portland high schools has become increasingly diverse. Last year, 46% of high school students identified as non-white. Mike Rosen is a member of the Portland Public Schools board who helps champion the student-led resolution. He believes the current narrative in classrooms about underrepresented cultures is in need of change.
We're either talking about how these cultures were exploited and helped by the white European culture, or we're talking about the burden of being a member of these cultures.
He says the goal of the Ethnic Studies course is to cover the histories of different racial groups in America, as well as the LGBTQ community. Hernandez says his group is considering pushing for ethnic studies in high schools statewide.
Portland Public Schools and having this resolution passed there is an amazing thing. And what I want to learn from it is, could we bring it to the state? So it's more of momentum towards bringing this to the statewide level.
I'm Emmy Kunze with the KBOO Evening News.
A federal judge in Seattle has ordered immigration officials to release an asylum-seeking teenage boy from a detention center in Tacoma. The teen fled Somalia after his father was murdered. He was placed in a foster home in Portland and enrolled in high school. In December, the boy was removed from the foster home after having a dental bone scan, which authorities said indicated he was an adult. The judge said the Office of Refugee Resettlement broke the law by solely using the x-rays to determine the boy's age. A law passed in 2008 disallows the government from determining age based only on the scans. While detained at the Tacoma facility, the teen said he was so scared that he couldn't sleep for days and could barely eat. He'll now be allowed to stay at his foster home until he turns 18.
Oregon's Department of Education issued a statewide guide yesterday advocating for safer policies for transgender students. They now join states such as Massachusetts and Connecticut, who have issued similar guidelines. While debates rage on in other states over transgender bathroom policy, Oregon's new guidelines offer a commitment to transgender student safety in schools, universities, and after-school programs. The new guidelines cite federal Title IX legislation, which outlaws discriminatory policies and practices based on gender. Examples of protections under the new policy include the ability to play sports, use lockers and restrooms, and dress according to one's chosen gender identity.
As the National Park Centennial approaches, a coalition of environmental and civil rights groups is asking President Obama to issue an executive order to ensure inclusion on public lands. The groups hope the next century of public lands will include more diverse Americans. David Kesters of KBOO News, in conjunction with the Oregon News Service, has more.
As the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service nears, a coalition of civil rights and conservation groups is calling for public lands to be more inclusive over the next century. The coalition has started a petition urging President Obama to issue an executive order to make public lands more diverse. Maite Arce, president of the Hispanic Access Foundation, says the coalition has the legacy of public lands in mind with this petition.
Our work here as a coalition is to challenge this president and also our next president to really embrace a vision for the next century of conservation that focuses on the importance of national parks and public lands for all Americans, with emphasis on all.
She says President Obama has already led the way by offering free access to national parks to every fourth grader and their families, and working with Native American communities to address concerns about copper mining. Arce says hiring a diverse workforce in order to hear from diverse voices is key to making public lands more inclusive.
There's always been, for many years, a discussion about the difficulty in reaching diverse communities, but without those individuals working on these lands and for our parks, it's really going to be difficult to develop programming that reaches and engages different populations.
Shantha Reddy Alonzo heads the Creation Justice Ministries, an environmental justice group that represents major Christian denominations. She thinks there should be more protections for the sacred parts of the public lands.
Right now, too many places where there are petroglyphs or we know that there are graves are being ravaged and disturbed because they're underprotected and underrecognized. We would like to see more reverence for those types of places.
The petition is online, along with policy recommendations, at change.org. For KBOO News, I'm David Kesters.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. That will be followed by Bread and Roses at 6, and at 7 it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. For Portland's weather, it will be clear tonight with a low of 56. Tomorrow it's sunny with a high of 82, and then a slight chance of rain tomorrow night with a low of 53. Today in history, in 1882, Congress passed the Chinese Exclusion Act, which barred Chinese immigrants from the United States for 10 years. It was one of the most significant restrictions on free immigration in U.S. history, prohibiting all immigration of Chinese to the United States. The quote of the day is from James Madison, author of the U.S. Constitution, who said, quote, "America was indebted to immigration for her settlement and prosperity. That part of America which has encouraged them most has advanced most rapidly in population, agriculture, and the arts," end quote.
And now the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
Workers Independent News Week in Review. I'm Doug Cunningham. Thursday was a national day of action in solidarity with the Verizon strike now entering its fourth week. 39,000 CWA and IBEW workers are striking to get a fair new labor contract, while the highly profitable company, $39 billion profit over the last 3 years, demands concessions and also the right to ship more American jobs overseas. The IBEW's Miles Calvi says this really is a struggle for the future of the American middle class.
This is the epitome of what's going on in this country right now. I mean, it's not a company that's destitute at all, and they still want major concessions. And instead of hiring off the street and replacing job for job as they leave or, you know, they can use the work, they want the ability to bring one person off the street and two jobs to go out of the country.
May 4th was a national day of action to reclaim public schools in 80 cities nationwide. The Alliance to Reclaim Our Schools, consisting of more than 100 community and labor organizations, organized the day of rallies, marches, and walk-ins for schools all our children deserve. It's a movement to defend public schools against privatization, attacks on teacher unions, and the erosion of public school budgets to feed private charter schools. Arlene Inoue is treasurer of the United Teachers of Los Angeles.
We had more than 150 public schools in the Los Angeles Unified School District participate, and we know that we're joined by tens of thousands of our counterparts in all regions of the country who are staging a series of demands that we want resources for our sustainable public community schools.
The Farm Labor Organizing Committee says the tobacco industry is turning a blind eye to child labor and dangerous working conditions in America's tobacco fields. Flock's Justin Flores says farm workers took the issues to the Reynolds American Shareholders Meeting this week in North Carolina.
Farm workers from different states, people from all over the place coming together in Winston-Salem to try to get the word out about what's happening so that Reynolds American can't keep hiding the facts from the public.
UFCW grocery workers at El Super in California have won an NLRB victory after the company refused to heed worker demands for better working conditions. Ernesto Arce has more from Los Angeles.
Thousands of grocery workers at 43 El Super locations in Southern California have been demanding better work conditions for years, including an end to union busting, paid sick leave, and a lift on the 32-hour work week limit. The National Labor Relations Board ordered Paramount-based El Super to pay 549 current and former employees a total of $363,000 in unpaid wages. About 600 workers at six El Super stores have been without a contract since September 2013.
Some of the things that we want included in this contract is, well, respect. A lot of workers are getting treated very poorly. We also want them to have access to paid sick leave as well as decent wages.
Workers Independent News provided by Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Last month's Drug Takeback Day prompted Northwest residents to turn in 16 tons of unwanted or expired prescription medication. The medicine was collected April 30th in a four-hour period across Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Alaska. The annual event is sponsored by the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, which says that nationally, 447 tons were collected. 8 out of 10 new heroin users began by abusing prescription painkillers and moved to heroin when they could no longer obtain or afford those painkillers. DEA officials say the majority of prescription drug abusers report in surveys that they get their drugs from friends and family. More than 20,000 drug overdoses were reported in 2014, 78 a day, according to the most recent statistics from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
A special panel advising the Food and Drug Administration has suggested for the second time since 2010 that doctors should be better trained at managing the risks of painkillers they prescribe. A similar move put in place 6 years ago is only voluntary. This may have led to the current national epidemic of opioid addiction and abuse, observers say. FDA figures show that fewer than half the doctors targeted by the effort have completed the training. The panel also said training and risk management plans should be required for prescribing all opioid painkillers. Right now, the measures only apply to long-acting drugs, including oxycodone, which slowly release their ingredients over 12 hours or more. An estimated 1.5 million medical professionals currently prescribe opioid painkillers in the United States. They wrote about 170 million prescriptions that were filled in 2015.
In the Philippines, some 55 million people are registered to go to the polls Monday, May 9th. They'll cast ballots in local and national elections, choosing a new president and vice president. As President Benigno Aquino III's six-year term comes to an end, the campaign rhetoric has been brutal. Surveys show a mayor from the southern Philippines, nicknamed the Punisher, is in the lead, winning over support with promises to clean up crime within 6 months of taking office. Madonna Virola reports from the Calapan City.
Vice President Binay, tiwala ang nasa sentro ng ating relasyon sa ating mga kababayan.
Presidential candidates presented their platforms and discussed the issues during a series of nationwide televised debates. The stakes here are high, and in a country of nearly 100 million people, spread across an archipelago of 7,100 islands, the issues are broad. While the economy has improved somewhat in recent years, widespread poverty and crime persists, and corruption runs rampant.
I am here because there is so much criminality.
Frontrunner Davao Mayor Rodrigo Duterte is also known as the Punisher. Duterte vows to curb corruption and crime in 3 to 6 months. And has admitted the ordered extrajudicial killings to cut crime in Davao. Duterte recently generated international outrage, especially among women's rights advocates, when a joke he made about an Australian missionary who was raped during a police riot went viral. Political rivals accuse him of ill-gotten wealth. But none of this has affected his solid supporters like Jumir, who owns a printing press. He offers to print Duterte's face on T-shirts for free.
Siguro masyado nang matagal yung kalayaan natin.
We've long been under a democratic rule. The country needs someone with a strong heart, courageous, to reduce criminality. Only the poor ones get punished.
Duterte has vowed to resume peace talks in Mindanao, which he says must include more rebel groups and address injustices committed against Muslims. He also wants to scrap a deal that allows U.S. military personnel to enter the Philippines for regular military exercises. He questions America's commitment to protecting the country in its territorial dispute with China, where he maintains the South China Sea belongs to the Philippines. And he supports LGBT rights, despite the topic's sensitivity in this predominantly Catholic country. But Duterte does not have a lock on the election. Following him in the latest polls is Mar Rojas, the administration's candidate.
We must stay the course.
Formerly the Interior and Local Government Secretary, Mar Rojas pledges to continue the programs of the outgoing administration, which he says should be credited for the country's economic growth. A former New York investment banker, he vows to address poverty and push the policy of creating a larger autonomous region for Muslims in the South. But while his platform is clear, many here perceive him as weak on implementation, stemming from his lackluster performance during Super Typhoon Yolanda 3 years ago that killed more than 6,000 people in the Visayas region.
Bilang isang babae, bilang isang nanay.
Another strong contender is political newcomer Grace Poe, who worked as preschool teacher in the U.S. in the 1990s. Poe was adopted into her Philippine family. Legal challenges to her nationality failed, with the Supreme Court deciding in her favor. Post's campaign has centered on hunger and malnutrition in the country, and she pledges to fight drugs and electoral fraud. Ballots in the Philippines separate the posts of president and vice president. The field for the number two position includes the son of a former dictator, Ferdinand Marcos, whose family has yet to acknowledge or pay for their ill-gotten wealth and human rights violations during the two-decades term of the older Marcos. But Marcos, the younger, dodges any real recognition of his family's crimes.
If during the time of my father, they were victimized in some way or another, of course we are sorry that that happened. Nobody wants that to have happened. But will I say sorry for the thousands of kilometers that were built? Will I say sorry for the power generation? Will I say sorry for the highest literacy rate in Asia? What am I to say sorry about?
Marcos is running against a handful of opponents, including incumbent Vice President Jejomar Binay of the United Nationalist Alliance and Lenny Robredo, whose popularity is growing fast as many find her an interesting alternative to the status quo. While new to politics, she is a human rights lawyer and provides legal services to the country's poor. But human rights advocate Doris Melgar fears a Duterte-Marcos outcome.
I'm positive on the result of the election, that the election will be general peaceful and the people's right to vote will be exercised.
Registered voters go to the polls Monday, and electoral reform advocates hope the Philippine tradition of buying and selling votes will give way to principled voting. John Winston Marunilia is a first-time and millennial voter. Marunilia says he is caught between casting his ballot for who he is expected to vote for and what his heart says. Madonna Virola, FSRN, Mindoro Island, The Philippines.
A massive wildfire in the tar sands region of Alberta, Canada continues to rage. The entire town of Fort McMurray, with more than 80,000 residents, is already emptied. Extremely hot, dry conditions led to a more than eightfold increase in the size of the fire since the evacuation order Tuesday afternoon. The fire has now slowed somewhat, but continues to spread. Today, emergency officials began moving thousands of the evacuees again, with airlifts and police-led convoys, back through the fire-ravaged town that they fled earlier in the week. Samantha Power reports from Edmonton.
Over 1,100 firefighters are on the ground and 145 helicopters in the air to fight a wildfire that has decimated a swath of northern Alberta. The fire quickly spread through 85,000 hectares, that's more than 210,000 acres, in and around Fort McMurray, the town closest to the Alberta oil sands. The massive fire has forced oil sands operations in the area to either slow down or shut down. Suncor's base operating plant has temporarily suspended operations to ensure worker safety. The plant, located 15 miles north of Fort McMurray, is not believed to be in danger of the south moving fire, but its work camps have become home to evacuees. Many of the oil sands deposits themselves are also north of the fire. The numbers vary according to the source and remain in a constant state of flux while the fire rages. The Office of the Provincial Government estimated Thursday evening that over 25,000 evacuees are being housed in work camps north of Fort McMurray, a town with just over 80,000 people before the fire. The nearby Fort Mackay First Nation has seen a rapid influx of over 5,000 evacuees in a town that is normally home to 700. Mikisew Cree First Nation Chief Steve Cortrell says Fort Mackay and Fort Chipewyan are safe and will continue to welcome evacuees trying to get off the highway, but that the communities also need to track down their own members who lived and worked in the Fort McMurray area.
So many people have been displaced in Fort McMurray that are my First Nation members. You know, they have no intentions of going home. They have homes that have been destroyed. Some of them left with just a clothing on their backs.
Cortrell says he would like to see a commitment from the province guaranteeing housing for all displaced First Nation members. Premier Rachel Notley, Alberta's provincial governor, admits it will be more than a few days for the assessment of need to even begin. For now, it's about connecting people with services. 1,500 cars are still spread out north of Fort McMurray. On Friday, the RCMP National Police Force began a convoy to escort them south, 50 at a time, to the city of Edmonton. Samantha Power, FSRN, Edmonton.
You're
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Emmy Kunze, Jamie Haddad, and Lisa Loving. The producer is David Kesters. Special thanks to Madonna Virola of FSRN. And our engineer for tonight is Ian Gadberry. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on More Talk Radio, Cecil Prescott and Celeste Carey speak with Douglas Ting about his book, Why Are Conservatives Always Wrong? Terrifying quotes from conservatives throughout American history. At 9, the Old Mole Variety Hour. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia. At 10:15 on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein speaks with Clark Williams Terry of the Sightline Institute about why the coal industry is on the ropes and what the Peabody coal bankruptcy means for communities that have been devastated by coal mining. At 11, Ellen Goldsmith hosts Health Watch. And at 11:30, we hear Progressive Spirit. John Shuck interviews author and atheist activist John Loftus about his book, How to Defend the Christian Faith, Advice from an Atheist. Thank you, KBOO members, for helping us get very close to our goal in our recent membership drive. Your support makes it all happen. And now stay tuned for Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses at 6.